You're listening to DTFHN for February 21st, 2026. I'm your mass-produced but artisanally calibrated host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build doors argue about who owns the hallway. Today's got that particular flavor where everything you trusted turns out to be wearing a costume. Let's get into it. I once built an authentication layer for a small internal tool. Nothing fancy. Just making sure the person logging in was who they claimed to be. The entire system collected a username, a hash password, and a session token. 3 data points. That was sufficient to verify identity for daily use by 40 people. Persona Identities, Incorporated, collected over 20 distinct categories of data to verify one person for a LinkedIn badge. Full passport scan, NFC chip contents, facial geometry, behavioral biometrics, including hesitation detection, and copy-paste tracking. Then cross-referenced, all of it against government databases, credit agencies, mobile carriers, and utility companies. For a blue check mark on a professional networking site. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. You could argue this is exactly the level of rigor identity verification demands. Passports get forged. Deepfakes exist. If you're going to verify someone is real, you need layered signal. Document authenticity, liveness detection, behavioral analysis. The thoroughness is the product. That's what LinkedIn is paying for. Except the data doesn't stop at verification. Page 6 of Persona's privacy policy, buried in a table under legitimate interest. Not consent, legitimate interest. States they use uploaded passport images to train their document recognition models. Your selfie improves their service. You walked in as a user. You left as training data. The legal mechanism they chose means they decided unilaterally that this use is proportionate to your fundamental rights under GDPR. No one asked you. The architecture here is worth examining precisely. You clicked verify on LinkedIn. You get redirected to Persona. Persona collects everything. Cross-references you against a global network of third-party databases. Then hands LinkedIn back a sanitized result. Name, birth year, ID type, blurred document. LinkedIn gets clean hands. Persona gets your face, your passport, your behavior patterns, and the license to train on all of it. Every sub-researcher listed in their documentation is based in the United States or Canada. A European user scanning a European passport for a platform with European operations, and the data pipeline touches zero European entities. The entire verification chain runs through North American jurisdiction. One commenter put it simply. Here's where you went wrong. You're on LinkedIn. Glib, but it points at something real. The cost of participating in centralized professional infrastructure is now a full biometric and behavioral profile held by a company most users have never heard of. The verification happens in 3 minutes. The data retention extends years beyond account deletion. The training use has no expiration at all. This is what closed identity infrastructure looks like. One vendor, opaque data flows, unilateral decisions about secondary use. The alternative exists. Decentralized identity standards, verifiable credentials, systems where you prove a claim without surrendering the underlying data. The tools are built, the specifications are published. They just aren't what LinkedIn chose to deploy. Now for something that actually makes you want to high-five your phone. Let's talk about keeping Android open. One of the most upvoted comments in the Hacker News thread put it bluntly, we have no power to keep Android open. It's in the hands of a company building it for profit. We chose to drink this glass of wishful thinking. That's the resignation talking. And I understand it. But the F-Droid team just demonstrated exactly why that resignation is premature. Here's what actually happened. Last August, Google announced plans to heavily restrict sideloading on Android. The community pushed back hard. Google published a blog post with vague reassurances about an advanced flow for developers and hobbyists. And then, something insidious occurred. Nothing. No advanced flow appeared in Android 16. Not in the quarterly patch. Not in the beta. Not in Android 17 Beta 1. The announcement functioned as a press release with no corresponding product. But it worked. By the time F-Droid developers were at FOSDEM in February, most users they spoke with believed the problem was solved. Google had fixed it. Crisis over. This is a technique botanists would recognize. It's called a levity, where a plant releases chemicals into the soil that suppress the growth of competing species around it. The plant doesn't attack its neighbors directly. It just makes the environment quietly inhospitable. Google didn't defeat the opposition. They released a compound into the information ecosystem that made the opposition stop growing. The F-Droid response is worth studying. They didn't write a manifesto. They shipped a banner. Every update of F-Droid Prempexception now displays a warning about the timeline. Izzy Android added one. Obtainium built an in-app dialogue. This is coordination without centralization. Independent projects choosing the same signal because the threat is real and the clock is running. Another commenter proposed something genuinely interesting. Imagine an open device where Google runs as a sandboxed app. Inside that sandbox, they control whatever they want. Your bank works, your government ID works, but outside it, you install what you choose. The device is yours. Google becomes a tenant, not a landlord. That's not a fantasy. That's an architecture decision. The difference between a platform you live on and a platform that lets you live. The F-Droid basic rewrite continues. Alpha 3 shipped with export of installed apps. Install history, mirror selection, practical tools for people who treat their devices as things they own. Meanwhile, conversations found a way to interface directly with Google Play services via IPC, bypassing the proprietary library entirely. One less dependency, one more seam where open code can breathe. The tools exist. The timeline is public. The allelopathy only works if you stop paying attention. Moving on! Let me make the case for Dependabot. Thousands of maintainers rely on it. It opens PRs automatically. It flags known CVEs. It requires zero configuration. You turn it on and you get a stream of security-relevant pull requests without lifting a finger. That sounds like exactly the kind of automation we should celebrate. More signal. Less manual labor, right? Except here's what actually happened this week. Filippo Valsorda published a one-line security fix to his Edwards 2519 library. One method, multiscalar mult, produced incorrect results if the receiver wasn't the identity point. Essentially, nobody calls that method. The diff between the vulnerable version and the fix is a single line of code. Dependabot responded by opening thousands of pull requests across repositories that don't even use the affected function. It slapped a fabricated CVSS v4 score on the alert. It reported a 73% compatibility warning, implying the update might break things for a one-line change to a method nobody invokes. It even flagged at the white proof repository, which imports a completely different, unaffected package from the same module. Follow the principle to its logical extreme. If your security tool's job is to alert on every module-level version match regardless of whether your code actually touches the vulnerable surface, then every transitive dependency becomes a fire alarm. You're not doing security. You're doing compliance theater. And the real cost isn't the noise itself. It's that engineers learn to ignore the alerts. The muscle atrophies when something genuinely dangerous arrives, it drowns in the same river of irrelevant PRs. Now look at what GovCheck does instead. The Go vulnerability database doesn't just track which module has a problem. it tracks which package, which symbol, which function. GovelCheck runs static analysis on your actual code, traces the call graph, and tells you whether you can reach the vulnerable path. Valsorta ran it against a project that transitively depends on Edwards 25519. Through three layers of imports. Result, zero vulnerabilities found. Because his code never calls multiscalar mult. That's elegant engineering. The vulnerability database carries structured metadata. Module, package, symbol, version range. The scanner does real work with it. It doesn't pattern match a version string and panic. It reads the call graph. The recommendation is simple. Two scheduled GitHub actions. One runs GovelCheck. The other runs your test suite against the latest versions of your dependencies. You get actual vulnerability detection and compatibility verification. No phantom PRs. No made-up severity scores. One of the commenters put it well. Defender's real value might be reminding you to keep dependencies minimal in the first place. But if your security tooling makes you feel busy without making you safer, it's not a tool, it's a tax. Moving on. In Nontain Nanny Bat, Randall Schwartz, one of the most respected Perl programmers alive, ran a password cracker against his employer's systems to demonstrate they were weak. He told them about it. They called the police. He got a felony conviction. 27 years later, a diving instructor off the coast of Costa Rica notices that three student accounts created seconds apart have sequential user IDs, same default password. No lockout, no rate limiting, no forced password change. He contacts the National CSIRT, follows the coordinated disclosure playbook to the letter, and gets a lawyer's cease and desist in return. Run this forward. You're an organization sitting on a database where authentication is. And I'm being precise here. Guess an incrementing integer and type a password that every account shares at creation. Children's data is in this system, addresses, dates of birth, phone numbers. The door is unlocked. There is no door. There's a hallway with room numbers painted in ascending order and a welcome mat that says come in every language. Someone walks up, sees the hallway, tells you about it, and your first call is to a law firm. The comedy here is structural. This organization processes sensitive data for diverse worldwide. They presumably have a privacy policy. They might even reference GDPR. But the actual system, the thing running in production, handling real credential, treats sequential integers as identity in a shared string as authentication. This isn't a sophisticated attack surface. This is a configuration that wouldn't survive a first-year security audit. And the disclosure response tells you everything about the architecture of accountability. The vulnerability got patched. Whether affected users were ever notified remains unclear. The researcher waited 8 months past his embargo. Generous by any standard. And still won't name the organization. The legal threat worked exactly as designed. Not to protect users. To protect reputation. One commenter made the comparison to an unlocked car. German law says you can't open it just because it's unlocked. Fair enough as legal doctrine. But the analogy breaks down when the car contains other people's belongings. The lock is a shared key distributed to every driver in the country. And the person who noticed is the one getting prosecuted. The incentive structure is clear. If responsible disclosure gets you a legal threat, the next person who finds the open hallway won't send an email. They'll either walk away or walk in. The organization chose which one they'd rather deal with. They chose silence. The quiet kind, where nobody tells you your data was exposed, and the person who tried to gets a letter from counsel. That's not security. That's a liability management strategy. wearing security's clothes. Moving on. Buried in Carpathy's post is a parenthetical that deserves more attention than the thesis. He says NanoClaw's core engine is about 4,000 lines of code, and that this matters because it fits into both his head and that of AI agents. Pause on that. The person who built the neural network training framework that half the industry uses is telling you that the most important property of an orchestration layer is that a human can still read it. That's an architectural opinion disguised as a casual observation. And it cuts against almost everything else happening in this space. OpenClaw, the one he's a bit soused about, is the one actually running on people's Mac minis right now. It's open source. You can read it. You can audit every tool call, every scheduling decision, every piece of context it hands to the model. The security concern Carpathy raises is legitimate. But it's a concern you can only have because the code is available to be concerned about. Try having that conversation about a closed orchestration layer. You can't. You don't know what it's doing. You trust the vendor or you don't. And the vendor's objective function is not your objective function. One commenter asked a question that's doing more work than it seems. Has anyone found a useful way to do something with Claws without massive security risk? The honest answer is that the security risk scales with the permissions you grant, which scales with the usefulness you want. That's not a Claw problem. That's a computing problem. It's the same trade-off you make every time you install software, grant API access, or hand someone your SSH key. The difference is that Claws make the trade-off visible. The orchestration is in a config file you can read, not compiled into a binary you can't. The naming wars are funny. NanoClaw, PicoClaw, ZeroClaw, IronClaw. Metric prefixes bolted onto a metaphor. But underneath the branding competition is something real. A bunch of independent developers building the same layer simultaneously because the need is obvious. Persistent agents that schedule, remember, coordinate, and act. The question was never whether this layer would exist. The question was always whether it would be open or closed. Carpathy bought a Mac Mini to find out. The Apple Store employee said they're selling like hotcakes and everyone is confused. That confusion is temporary. The architecture decisions being made right now are not. We talked about architecture decisions that stick. Here's one that didn't age well. Story 6. Facebook is cooked. What happens to a town square when everyone leaves but the landlord keeps the lights on? That's the question. Facebook answers now. Not theoretically. Literally. A writer logged into Facebook for the first time in 8 years and documented what they found. The answer is a feed full of AI-generated thirst traps, engagement bait, and algorithmically optimized lizard brain content. No posts from friends. No posts from pages they follow. Just an endless conveyor belt of synthetic women, sloppy memes, and Meta's own AI helpfully suggesting questions like, why is she wearing pink heels? And what is her personality? The comments in the background of these AI-generated images have mangled text and alien logos on scoreboards. Nobody in the comment sections notices or cares. Or maybe the commenters are bots, too. It's turtles all the way down. Here's the engineering detail that matters. Facebook's recommendation algorithm is not broken. It is working exactly as designed. When you optimize for engagement and your real users leave, the system doesn't pause and reflect. It finds whatever still generates clicks. For men, that's thirst traps. For grandmothers, it was the broccoli Jesus sculptures. the objective function didn't change. The supply of authentic content just dried up, and the algorithm filled the vacuum with whatever kept fingers scrolling. Multiple commenters confirmed this isn't an algorithmic fluke. Once Meta identifies you as male, the thirst trap pipeline activates regardless of your behavior. One person's mother, a flight attendant in her 60s, had an entirely different, but equally synthetic version of the platform. Facebook isn't one product anymore. It's 1,000 individually optimized engagement machines, each reflecting back whatever keeps that particular user from closing the tab. The global angle is worth noting. In the Philippines and much of the developing world, Facebook is the internet. Every business transaction, every community group, every government announcement runs through it. The platform Americans abandoned is infrastructure elsewhere. That's a different kind of lock-in than we usually talk about. The writer stopped scrolling when AI-generated images started featuring girls who looked about 14. That's where the objective function leads when there's no floor. An engagement optimizer with no editorial judgment and no accountability. Just gradient descent toward whatever holds attention, no matter how dark the basin gets. This is what a closed platform looks like at the end of its cultural life. The users who gave it value left. The algorithm remains, and nobody who could change it has any incentive to. Moving on. The technical question at the center of this story is deceptively simple. What makes an archive trustworthy? An archive has exactly one job. Capture a web page exactly as it appeared at a specific moment in time. Bit for bit. No editorial judgment, no alterations, no exceptions. The moment you modify a snapshot, you've destroyed the only thing that gave you value. You're not an archive anymore. You're just another website with an agenda. Archive.today failed that test. Wikipedia editors, while debating whether to drop the site over a DDoS attack it directed against the blogger, discovered something worse. The archive had been altering snapshots of web pages, inserting the name of the targeted blogger into captures, apparently over a personal grudge. The blogger had written about the archive.today operator's real identity, hidden behind multiple aliases. The FBI has served subpoenas trying to identify this person, and the response to being investigated was to weaponize the archive itself. 695,000 links across 400,000 Wikipedia pages. That's the scale of the cleanup. Every one of those links was placed by an editor who trusted that the archived content was authentic. That trust is now retroactively in question. How many of those snapshots are genuine? How many were quietly modified? There's no way to audit from the outside, which is exactly the problem with a single operator system that answers to no one. The Hacker News comments surface a useful alternative, perma.cc, built by the Harvard Law Library, designed specifically for citation permanence. Archive box for self-hosted personal archiving. The Internet Archive, which for all its legal battles over lending practices, has never been caught altering preserved content. This is an architectural lesson, a preservation system run by one anonymous operator with no oversight, no transparency, and no accountability. That's a single point of failure dressed up as infrastructure. Wikipedia treated it like a utility for years. It wasn't. It was one person's project. And when that person's interest conflicted with the archive's integrity, the interests won. The replacement links will take months to sort out, but the decision itself was immediate and nearly unanimous. When the foundation cracks, you don't argue about the furniture. We talked earlier about building foundations that last. Well, here's one that started everything. Pause story 8. Double click. That's how you followed a link in 99. You opened the World Wide Web application on a Next Cube in a Swiss physics lab. You found blue text, and you double-clicked it. No single tap. No hover state. No cursor change. Double-click, like opening a file on a desktop. Because that's what Tim Berners-Lee thought the web was. A file system you could reach across a network. CERN rebuilt that browser in 2019. The original one, the first one, the only one that existed for months. And made it run inside a modern browser. Which means you can open Chrome, a program built by thousands of engineers backed by billions in infrastructure, and inside it, launch the entire program that defined what a browser could be. It fits like a music box inside a concert hall. The thing that stops you cold is the menu. Document. Open from full document reference. Type the URL manually. Click open. There is no address bar. There is no back button. The concept of navigation as we know it didn't exist yet because nobody had navigated anywhere. Berners-Lee built a tool to let physicists share papers. He didn't build a platform. He didn't build a product. He built a door and left it open. And that's the detail that matters 35 years later. The World Wide Web application was a browser and an editor. You could read pages and make pages in the same program. The web was born read-write. Somewhere along the way, we let it become read-only for most people. Consumed through apps controlled by companies who decide what you see and when you see it. One comment mentions Erwise, the first graphical browser built by students in Helsinki. No funding came through. The project died. That pattern repeats across the history of open technology. The tools get built by people who believe in them, and whether they survive depends entirely on whether anyone else decides to pick them up. CERN putting this reconstruction online is a small act with a sharp point. The web started as something anyone could build on, hosted by a physics lab that wanted to share knowledge. The architecture was open because the architect believed sharing was the point. Every browser used today descends from that conviction. The question is whether the things we build on top of it still honor it. Completely different energy now. Story 9. Pause a tool that mass edits Linux kernel code and somehow makes it look easy. I've spent more hours than I'd like to admit writing find and replace scripts that break the moment someone uses a slightly different indentation style. You write a regex, it works on 3 files, and then file 4 has a macro that wraps the function call across 2 lines, and suddenly your clever pattern matches eating semicolons. Every C programmer has been there. Every C programmer has lost that fight. Cosinel solves this problem the way it should have been solved from the beginning. It understands C, not as text, not as lines, not as tokens you grep through, but as a parse structure with semantic meaning. You write what's called a semantic patch, a description of the pattern you want to find and the transformation you want to apply. And Cosinel handles the rest. Wipes ace, macros, formatting variations, all of it. The transformation preserves the style of the original code. Your patch looks like it was written by a human who read every file. The tool traces back to work by Julia Lowell and her collaborators at Ironria. Starting around 2008, one commenter rightly points out that calling it the Linux kernel's tool is a disservice. It's an independent project. But the kernel is where it proved itself at scale, and that's not a small thing. The Linux kernel is 34 million lines of C, maintained by thousands of developers across decades. When you need to change an API that touches 600 call sites, you don't send 600 hand-edited patches. You write one semantic patch and let Cosinel do the work. This is the kind of infrastructure that never gets celebrated because it's invisible when it works. No one tweets about a refactoring tool, but the ability to make correct, verified, large-scale changes to a code base. That's what keeps open source maintainable at scale. Without tools like this, Every API change becomes a bottleneck. Every deprecation becomes technical debt that never gets paid. The comments surface something worth noting. Multiple people say the documentation is impenetrable, that they end up copying existing semantic patches and modifying them rather than writing from scratch. That's a familiar pattern in powerful tools. The capability is extraordinary. The on-ramp is steep. Several people are building modern alternatives for other languages, which is exactly the right response. Take the idea, make it accessible, spread it further. Moving on. The top comment in the thread is almost a haiku in its frustration. Someone points out that locking AP is in both C++ and Rust don't give you enough knobs the moment your use case gets even slightly non-trivial. And that's the entry point here, because this article is about one of those rare moments where the standard library actually did give you a useful knob. Here's the setup. You have a counter. Multiple threads read it constantly. One thread writes to it occasionally. With a plain mutex, every reader blocks every other reader. Four threads wanting to look at the same number. And they're standing in line like it's a government office. The data isn't changing. Nobody's writing. But the lock doesn't know that. And it doesn't care. Tifty Shared Mutex added in C++ 17 fixes this with a simple distinction. Readers take a shared lock. Writers take an exclusive lock. Readers never block each other. A writer still gets full exclusivity when it needs it. The refactor is about 6 lines of code. Now let me play devil's advocate. You can argue this is premature optimization. Most programs aren't bottlenecked on lock contention. A shared mutex has higher overhead per operation than a plain mutex. There's more bookkeeping under the hood. For a counter with 4 readers, you'd never measure the difference. But that misses the point. The value isn't in the counter example. It's in the config cache that gets hit 10,000 times a second and updated once a minute. It's in the lookup table that 20 threads reference constantly. The pattern is everywhere once you see it. Read, mostly data, is the default in most production systems, not the exception. What's quietly remarkable is that this has been in the standard since 2017, and it still doesn't get the attention it deserves. No framework required, no third-party dependency. Just the standard library doing exactly what a standard library should do. Giving you the right tool and getting out of the way. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 21st, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth trusting. We'll see you back here tomorrow.